Welcome to the JCC, our first post-Barbara Sugarman JCC Coffee, Cake, and Learning, Walking in the King's Orchard. So let's have a little preface, if we will, a preview. We know that in our Torah, there are 613 mitzvot midaraita. In English, biblical commandments. And the rabbis divide them up, 248 of them, which parallel the human body, are positive mitzvah, positive commandments. Do honor your father and mother, believe in God, etc., etc. And there are 365 that are lo taseh, thou shalt not do them. Do not murder, do not commit adultery, etc., etc. Now, it's daunting because even though there's a magic number of 613, you can't keep all 613. It's impossible because some are for men, some are for women, many, many, many. One has to be living actively in the land of Israel with a functioning temple, a Beit HaMikdash. So we're precluded from all of them. However, many of us, I'm including myself, at least attitudinally, we think of the mitzvot, the commandments, sort of like a smorgasbord, right? And you walk around the smorg, and we all know that if you have, let's say, a 613-item smorgasbord, all right, that could be at a very fancy-schmancy, you know, Mark Zuckerberg chasana at a wedding, you never know, right? You're gonna be naturally attracted to certain items on the smorg to the detriment of the other items. You're always going to be looking around because there's a plethora of items, and you're going to be attracted. So that's kind of psychologically how we are with the Torah commandments. We all know from personal experience there are certain commandments that we are attracted to that are, they speak to us, they're sensible, and we taste the reason and the rhyme and the reason behind a commandment. And then there are others that are kind of like standoffish because maybe we look at them, we say, oh my gosh, I don't really connect with that at all. So, surprise, surprise, thou shalt not be surprised, that there are categories. One of the categories are specifically commandments called mishpatim, for lack of a better word, is a nice word for you, ordinances. That's how they commonly translate that word. And they're essentially commandments that are reasonable commandments. What does that mean? So, for example, you don't have to teach a human being that there's something called, well, maybe you do in today's society, there's something called tzniut, modesty. Unfortunately, our society is immodest both in dress and more so in personal behavior, especially with the online, the way they personally desecrate their own lives and families. Okay, but be that as it may, in a conceptual form, one would say, well, you know, if God did not ordain at Mount Sinai that it's important for men and women to be modest. Tzniut. You could look, the rabbis and the Talmud say, at your neighborhood or your friendly little cat. Gal.
That's right.
Gal is Mark's cat. Gal Gadot. Gal. Named after the great Wonder Woman herself.
Yeah, that's right.
Hero. So Gal the cat is different from the dogs that we love. So there are cat people, dog people, and many of you might be both, right? Great. But you do notice that with the dogs, there's like no public decency at all. They do their stuff very publicly, probably on your lawn, and then the poor owners have to have the plastic glove and the little plastic bag. That I have to tell you, really have to love your dog to walk around. You see people in Manhattan because there's ordinances there. You can get fined, you know, for public, you know what. And the people have professional dog walkers, and these poor people will go out with four or five dogs, right, from their neighbors, and they do this as a favor. They go out with four dogs, and they all do their business, and they all have to, right? It's like crazy. You really have to love your dog a lot to do this. But cats, you don't have to worry. Not only do you not have to walk your cat out for their evening soiree, but the cat won't even, like she won't even let you know. Gal won't even let you know when she's doing her business. She would be mortified if you caught her doing her thing. She buries it somewhere, and she's like, what, me? I don't know. That's not right. I don't do that, right? So the rabbis say, and it's very serious, that if God did not ordain tzniut, the idea of modesty, we could simply look at the role model of a cat and say, oh, well, if a cat is modest, a human being, kol shiken. However more so, should humans strive to be like a pussycat and modest in that way. So there are laws, rules, Torah commandments that are called mishpatim, ordinances, that speak to the human being. And then there are others that don't speak at all. So, for example, there is a rule that we don't wear mixtures of certain types of materials. Wool and linen and little mixtures. So, for example, I just bought our son Tully a suit, beautiful 100% wool Joseph A. Banks suit, and I had to take it to a rabbi in Scranton to get it tested for what's called chatnets. Now, nobody I've ever met, other than the rabbi who makes money testing, I'm joking, has ever said, oh my gosh, chatnets, not wearing a mixture of wool with a little strand of linen, that is why I'm a religious Jew, right? I would have to get them psychologically analyzed if that was the case, right? Nobody ever said, oh, it speaks to me, or the red heifer. The best example of all time. We don't even understand. It's not understandable. Even King Solomon lacked understanding of the red heifer. We've spoken about this in other classes. So no one ever said, oh my gosh, the red heifer and the concept of taking the ashes and mixing it with Poland Springs water to purify someone from ritual impurity. That speaks to me. That motivates me in the morning to get up and pray to God and come to Rabbi Kaplan's Torah classes. I would say, you need some help if that was the case, right? So we see that we always have a smorgasbord, at least mentally. So today we're going to explore the pros and cons of treating the Torah as a shmor. What would be okay to do and what would not be okay to do. So this past parsha, this past Torah reading from Shabbat past, is a very strange parsha by name. It's called Akev. And the word Akev is so mysterious because it could be used in so many other ways. So, for example, if it wants to mean if, im, short, little, one-syllable word, im, if, we use it like literally in the same Torah reading where we say, v'hoya im shamoa tishma'u, if you will surely listen to my commandments. But it doesn't use the word if, it says this mysterious word Akev. And the rabbis all have, because rabbis are very big fans of having multiple approaches, they all have their own, what's called a mahalich, their own approach to what it means, how you translate it and what it means, clearly not necessarily in a literal way, but perhaps in a metaphorical way. So, Akev. So here's the opening. Look at source one, please. I'll read it to you in the English. And it will be Vihaya. I made it nice and large. Akev, because, that's they're translated as because, Tishma'un, you will heed, you will listen, Eta Mishpatim, there's that word, ordinances that we mentioned, Ha'ela, these ordinances, Ushmartem, and you'll guard them, you'll keep them, Va'asitemotam, and perform them, Vishamar Hashem Elokecha, God, Lord God, will keep you, will guard you, the covenant, the brit, the covenant, the etechesed, and the kindness, asher nishba lavatach, that he swore to your forefathers. So again, here, instead of saying, im tishma'un et mishpatim, it will be that if you, or because you keep these commandments, God keeps his end of the bargain. Right? So the mystery is, why come up with that word? And I put it in bold so you can see the words. It's the second word in Hebrew, Akev. That's the word we're trying to understand. Why use this mysterious word that has all these, perhaps, applications? So let me give you a couple of them. So Akev could mean, metaphorically, the following. We have a human body from top to bottom. Rosh is the head. Zanav would be the tail, the bottom. We actually use that term on Rosh Hashanah. We have a special blessing, right? Some people eat a head of a fish or they have a blessing. They say, this following year coming up, Rosh Hashanah, New Year, we should be L'Rosh V'lo L'Zanav. Maybe we be at the head of the year and not the tail end of the year. But it doesn't say tail end, it says heel. So conceptually, from top to bottom, you start with the head and you end with your heel. So it's a nice, fancy schmancy way of giving over Akev, that it's at the end of a process, you'll get a reward from God if you uphold his Torah, his commandments. What does that mean? In the next world. At the end of the process means the next world, heaven, olam haba, the world to come. All right, that's a nice added, right? So we're treating the heel, because the word Akev literally means someone's heel. So it's the end of a process, the bottom of a person's foot. However, the greatest of all Torah commentators was Rashi, Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki. He is the first rabbi that we try to open up and interpret whenever there's a verse in the Torah, any verse. We cite him first, Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchak. He commented on every word of the Bible, of the five books of Moses, plus 2,700 folios of Talmud. He did it three times, his third iteration, which is the only one we have. He didn't quite finish it, so one of his grandchildren finished it for him. But he is so formidable that he commented, I mean, there's a joke like this. Here's my joke, my Rashi joke. Okay, so again, Rashi is the formidable Torah commentator of all time. So one night, he's sitting here with his quill, and he's writing one of his commentaries, and Mrs. Rashi is heading out the door to a ladies' auxiliary meeting. Hadassah, okay? So he picks up his head, and he sees his wife leaving. He says, "Dear, I'm not sure that that hat and that outfit go together." She looks at him and says, "Rashi, dear, do you have to comment on everything?" I thought that was kind of cute. And by the way, his daughters, he didn't have any sons, but his daughters were like amazing. The Benot Rashi, they actually wore tefillin, believe it or not. And they were, I mean, I would never want to try to outfox, outwit, or learn greater. Like, can you imagine? His daughters were like off the charts geniuses, the Benot Rashi. And his grandchildren became the Tosafot, the great number one Torah commentators other than himself on the Talmud. So like he had incredible genetics. That was Rashi. Okay. Now, Rashi then, let's look at what he has to say. Source 2. So how does he understand that mysterious word, akev, heal? "And it will be because you will heed." So listen to Rashi. The Hebrew word akev literally means a heel. So what is God telling us? If you will heed the minor commandments, which one usually tramples with his heels, in other words, which a person treats as being of minor importance. Wow. So this is a totally different approach that I believe is going to be our approach today to try to unpackage, because he's Rashi. We got to understand, what is he talking about? So again, here's what he's saying. Your heel is a metaphor for here, how we look, how we view things in our world. And we all, as we said at the outset, if you have the 613 commandments of our Torah, of our Bible, laid out like a beautiful metaphorical smorgasbord that we're going to get romantic about, you just say, oh my gosh, has anyone ever been to a very religious Jewish wedding with a smorg? The smorg is sort of short for smorgasbord. So anyone will tell you that the food at the weddings are okay if you can last for hours, but get there early because the smorg. Right? Am I right, Rabbi Kamosha? You've been to incredible smorgs, right? The smorgs are like they have stations with like five people cutting roast beef for you and sushi stations handmade. You're like, it's ridiculous, okay? I mean, you walk around there and you think, oh my gosh, this is a little maybe over the top sometimes, but it's get there an hour early. That's why the Jewish people who know their food, right? The foodies, when they look at that invitation, they get there early because the smorgasbord is open at that moment and you get there early, right? Exactly, because you know. So the smorgasbord of life then, we are saying that we as humans are naturally attracted to the commandments that speak to us. Now, individually, some may speak to you more than others. There's no one common denominator. All right? Well, actually, there are a couple. Let me give you one that everyone relates to. Ready? Unless your name is Adam and Eve, and you have to be the original model. So probably not sitting in our room right now. Okay, so Adam and Eve are the only humans that we know of that didn't have the fifth commandment in our Ten Commandments, which is coming up again, that we read it on Shabbat. Honor
your parents.
Your parents. Honor thy father and thy mother, right? They didn't have that. So except for Adam and Eve, everybody else has that commandment. It is the most accessible, most profound command that each and every one of us, we connect to from infancy, probably because mom and dad drill it into you, right? But conceptually, you say, well, why would I honor my mother and father? Well, hello, where would you be without, and again, if the world, if If humanity relied on men to give birth, I truly believe that we would not exist. It's the wonderful women of our lives who have the courage to go through childbirth, 9 months plus, and incredibly, you hear stories of like once, twice, five times in the religious world, 10 children, 12 children. It's unbelievable, right? Again, if it was guys, right, Doc, you believe this, right? Because he, yes. Right, yeah, he's looking at me like, yeah, guys, we are not up to that. Okay, so 100% to honor your father. In fact, that's why it says you have to honor your father before it says honor your mother. You know why? Because we naturally honor our mother. She's with us more. She has a more profound connection to us. So we prioritize dear old dad to say, oh, no, 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 no. We put him before mom because we're saying, no, you even have to honor old dad, not just mom, who automatically is the beneficiary of our love and our attention. So both, everybody in the world, Jew and non-Jew alike, connect to this. It is the ultimate, most beautiful item on the menu. Now, how do I know this? I have a proof. You see, when God gave the Jewish people the Torah, the Bible at Mount Sinai, the nations of the world, they heard about it, right? Now, today they would hear about it instantly because there'd be like instant posts and people would be like, boom, 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 as God says, believe in God, do not have any gods before me, right? They would be tweeted out, X'd out in cyberspace. So it took a little longer. But when they heard about the revelation at Mount Sinai, according to the Talmud and Kedushin, they were not so impressed. Because the first commandments are kind of God-centric commandments. Believe in God. Thou shalt not have any other gods before me. Don't use the name of God in vain. Keep Sabbath because I, God, rested on the Sabbath. So those first four, right? They're kind of like, you know, right? They're kind of like God. So they all were like unimpressed because they said, well, this is not revolutionary. Every religion and the God or gods of those religions prioritizes their honor. This is nothing new. Oh, they got to number five. You shall honor your father and your mother. They said, wait a minute. Wow, this is new. Honor your father and mother. And if you honor father and mother, you're ultimately honoring God because he's the third partner. He's the silent partner with mom and dad in our creation. Wow, this is revolutionary. And the nations were so inspired, it says in the Talmud, they went backwards, at least emotionally, and said, you know what, if this fifth commandment, honoring mom and dad, is so profound, so perfect, it must be that there's truth even in the other ones that we thought was all for the honor of God. We need to accept them also. And they accepted the Ten Commandments. It was great. So every nation on earth, not just the Jewish people, can connect to that fifth commandment. It's the most accessible, if you will, of all the commandments. It's not a mystery at all. It has reasons, and it's just physiology. So it's great. It's wonderful. So it is the ultimate expression of a commandment that we perceive as being holy. Now, how do I know? Who is the most famous purveyor of the commandment in the Torah, in the Bible, of honoring mom and dad? Esau. Esau. Can you imagine? The guy who's the murderer, big brother of Jacob, who fathers really bad nations, who really hurt us, like the Roman Empire, we are told, comes from his nation. So he's not a good guy. But nobody honored, at least dad, he didn't honor his mom, but he honored Isaac, his father, greater than anyone. He used to have a special set of royal clothing, and he would adorn himself with the clothes and make special kosher food with the kosher supervision just for dear old dad. And he would go in dressed as like he was in the presence of a king, and he would honor his father, Isaac. So nobody honored a parent more than Esau did, yeah? And yet, he's not a good guy. So for sure, if Esau, as the ultimate outlier of a purveyor of this commandment, if he can make sense and says, oh, I got to keep this law, then everybody understands we got to keep the law of honoring mom and dad. We honor them in life. We can honor them in death by yard sites. We say Kaddish for them when they pass. We have Yisker services to memorialize them in synagogues. So we honor them both in this world and in the next world. It's a very profound law. Nobody would metaphorically trample on that commandment. Nobody. So we have to understand then, what type of commandments are this category that Rashi here says, minor commandments? And the word for minor in Rashi lingo here is the word kal, a mitzvah kala, a simple, light mitzvah. What do you mean? What do you mean by a light mitzvah? So a light mitzvah means it's something that is light in our perspective, in our eyes. We perceive it to be less consequential than others. Now, before you feel guilty, everybody, myself included, we all connect, as we said, to certain commandments. And others are like mysterious, and we do them maybe because we feel obliged. Hey, it's part of the rules, okay? But naturally, some are accessible, some are not. Now, here's the cool thing. This is wonderful. You don't need to understand all 613 to buy in. If you get the profound understanding of God's world, and even if you only have two or three or four or seven, there are seven Noahide laws that every human being in the world, Jew and non-Jew alike, we're all children, we're all brothers and sisters from Noah after the flood. So those seven rules, and they echo many of the Ten Commandments. If you buy into those seven, you're a good guy or a girl. You're wonderful. You're a tzaddik. You're a wonderful person. You're a righteous person. So everyone can connect in certain ways. But nobody would dare trample on one of those seven Noahide laws. You would never say, well, don't murder. People do, unfortunately. But usually they hide their real intentions. That they say, well, I'm not really a murderer. Okay. Be that as it may, we need to understand, what does the word kal mean, light? So the Talmud discusses a mitzvah kala. It actually discusses it. It says, you know what it means? Commandments that don't cost a lot of money. And what would the example be? So one of their examples is sukkah. So we build a little tabernacle, a little mini hut during the seven-day holiday of Sukkot, 8 days here outside of Israel. And people go out and they have meals in their little, you've probably seen the little huts, the tabernacles. Now, once upon a time, they didn't cost a lot of money. You know why? Because Israel was an agricultural society. So it was easy to put together a little sukkah. Now today, people go to the ends of the earth to get very fancy schmancy sukkahs, right? They cost hundreds and hundreds of dollars. And the things that we use that citron, that etrog. And I am not exaggerating. Okay, if you go to certain very religious areas in New York and in Jerusalem, and it's a couple days before Sukkot, you have mainly men, because the women are probably doing other more important things, but the men are scouring the markets, right? And they have their jeweler's glasses. The only reason that they don't have an electron microscope, because it's not portable. I'm not exaggerating. Rav Yaakov Moshe, did you ever see someone with a jeweler glass? I have. Yes. And what they do is they take that citron and they put their jeweler glass on it, you know, that you buy a diamond, and they're looking over every little, making sure there's no pagam, there's nothing deficient in the coloring or that. So they don't take it as a minor commandment. So I can't be talking then about how much something costs monetarily. Yeah? It must be something else. So that can't be the Talmud's, it doesn't fit what the Talmud defines as light, meaning cost. That doesn't work. So why do we call the class Walking in the King's Orchard? So I'm glad you asked. So the king has an orchard. This is now a midrash, a famous oral tradition. And in the king's midrash, he has a field. He has a pardes. And he has workers in the field. You'll see the parallel in a moment. And the king has workers, and they're paid workers. How are they paid? They're not salaried. They're paid by the plantings that they successfully plant and nurture in the king's orchard. But what did the king not do? He did not inform his workers which of the plantings pays more than the other plantings, for fear that if he let it be known that this category of plantings is worth 1,000 shekels, but this planting is only worth 25 shekels, the workers are not idiots. They're going to ignore the 25 shekel plantings and occupy themselves wholly with the 1,000 shekel plantings. And what would happen to the king's orchard? It would be gone. Because you'd have big parts of the orchard that would be unplanted, untended, uncared for, and it would destroy everything. Do you see the metaphor? The king, of course, is Hashem, God. Who are the workers? We're the workers. What are the plantings? The mitzvot, the commandments. So he's saying that I will not divulge, God the king says to his workers, the actual merits, the actual reward for any commandment that I'm going to give you. You know why? Because if I did, you would only prioritize those that are the valuable ones that get you maximum brownie points in your heavenly bank account to the detriment of all the others. And I don't want to have that relationship with you. I want to have a holistic relationship where all of the field, all of the orchard is mind intended for by my people. I don't want you picking and choosing the smorgasbord items that you do to the detriment of the others. Okay? So it's a very beautiful idea. And this works perfectly walking in the king's orchard. In other words, if you trample with your heel on any of the commandments because you perceive in your mind that this commandment is worthy of my attention, devotion, and observance, but not so much that one, then what happens? It fractures a relationship. Now think about it. I don't have to buy into everything I do, but I do have to buy into the brit, to the covenant, to a relationship. Let's go back to the parallel of mom and dad. What is the worst possible thing a child can say to mom and dad? Why do I have to? I said this a lot. And mom and dad are not suitably impressed when you say why. Because what? Why? Because I told you that you need to do this. Please go do this. And if they get really offended, they'll say, because I told you to. Go do it now, right? All right. Why is it so offensive to mom and dad? Because asking why sabotages the relationship and trust that we have with our parents. Clearly, mom and dad are asking us to do something because it's in our benefit. It's in our interest. They love us. We love them. So by me questioning the observance or participation in certain things undermines potentially my relationship with my mom and dad, yeah? So the same thing with Hashem, with God. That if I pick and choose, if I cherry pick, to use a little orchard lingo, if I cherry pick those that I like, what does that say about my trust and devotion to God? And that is why, brilliantly, when God offered us his Torah, his Bible at Mount Sinai, first he went to the nations of the world. Now, I don't know what this really means because clearly it didn't happen the way we perceive it. But let's just play along, okay? So he went to the nations of the world. He wanted to give all the other nations on earth, there were 70 fundamental languages. We know this from the Tower of Babylon when they had 70 languages that spread out all over the earth. So there are 70 defined nations, of the original nations. And he went to each of those nations. So for example, he went to Esau's children called the Edomites. And he said to the Edomites, do you want my Bible, my Torah? I haven't given it to anybody. It only exists in heaven. There's not even an art scroll edition yet. Do you want to buy in? Do you want to be my chosen people? And the Edomites said, yeah. Yeah, of course. But what is in this Torah? What is in the Bible? What do you mean, God said? What do you mean what's in the Bible? I wrote it. It's up in heaven. I'm gonna, we'll print it off nicely. Well, could you give me a sample chapter? Because I'm not really sure I want to buy in. So you want a sample chapter, God said? Really? You need a sample chapter. Okay. Don't murder. It's number 6. So the Edomites turned red, because they were red. Sorry. And they said, don't murder. God, we're Edomites. Esau, remember the red hair? We have a nature of bloodlust in our genes. That's the sample chapter. And they said, no, this is not for us. And they said, we pass. And then he went to the Moabites, descended from an ancestral relationship with Lot and his daughters. And he said to the Moabite nation, hey, do you guys want to be one, my chosen people? Again, they said, can we have a sample chapter? God said, you want a sample chapter? Okay, don't commit adultery. What? You realize, God, that we came from an incestuous relationship, father and daughter. We're not into this type of morality. We like that stuff, so we're out. We like licentious behavior. We're gone. We take a pass. Then he went to the Ishmaelites. Ishmael, the first son of Abraham. And he said, do you guys want my Torah? And the Ishmaelites said, again, sample chapter, please. You see, Amazon does not do us a good service. They have that little sample chapter. It actually saved me from buying really bad books. Because I can't stand reading a novel that is written in first person. I want the God narrator. It has to be a really good book. My wife says, even though it's written first person, you'll like it. And she knows me. Because I always feel if it's written first person in actual real time, I always feel like there's great conversations, things happening off screen, and I don't know where they are because I'm only getting the narrator's perspective in the little hut, right? So that's just me. So sample chapters could be good. But Yishmael wants a sample chapter. God says, really want a sample chapter? How about don't steal? What? We're Yishmaelites, you know, we're really good hagglers. Not always the most honest hagglers, you know. We're going to pass on that one. And he went to every nation, and they all said, nope. And then he went to the Jewish people. Do you want my Bible? And he went to us last. You know why? Because then the other nations can't have a recrimination. They can't have a defense. Say, oh, look at the Jews. They're not observing the Bible. If you had offered it to us, we would be better than them. And God say, really, guys? I offered it to you, and you said no. So be quiet. Jewish people, do you want my Bible? Yep. And God's waiting. Sample chapter? No. God said, really? This is unusual. No sample chapter? No. Really? You sure? Yeah. Nas of an Ishmael. We'll do it. I'm in. We'll learn about the stuff tomorrow and when I go to Hebrew school. But I don't need to know now. I'm in. I love you, God. Whatever is in your Bible, obviously, is great because you're God and you wrote it. What do I need a sample chapter for? And God said, that's what I was waiting for. Thank you. Nasif and Ishmael. That's mom and dad, right? In other words, if mom and dad say, this is good for you, for us to question, well, why is it good for you? Basically, mom and dad are going to say, shut up, do it, right? If they don't get outright angry. So this is the relationship we have. So what if my attitude says, this is a priority of the commandments, not so much this part. What does that say about my relationship with God? It undermines my relationship with God. And that is why we dare not trample with our heels in the king's pardes, in the king's orchard. Now, what is the vaccine? Sorry, I know RFK is not a big vaccine guy. But what is the kosher vaccine that we could take to inoculate ourselves? Right? How do you deal? Because it's an attitude. And we said, everybody, I'm guilty. We're all guilty. I'm naturally much more attracted to certain commandments than others. That's just who I am. Your experience and your life experiences are going to dictate how you look at things. That's normal. It's humanity. So please, how do I get past the idea that it is, according to this Rashi, this first incredible insight from Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki, that it is human nature that we prioritize some over the others. So what is it saying? That you dare not trample them. So that's not a physical thing, that's attitude. Yeah? Well, let's go back to the Garden of Eden, shall we? Look at source 3. I like going back to the Garden of Eden because we mentioned Adam and Eve. So now we're back with Adam and Eve, right? And the Lord God said to the Nachash, to the serpent, after the serpent convinced Adam and Eve to eat from the Eitz Hadas, the tree of knowledge, right? Because you serpent, have done this. Cursed be you more than all the cattle, more than all the beasts of the field. God is speaking to the snake. You shall walk on your belly and you shall eat dust all the days of your life. And I shall place hatred between you and between the woman and between your seed and between her seed. He will crush your head, meaning humans will crush your head. Oh my gosh. And you will bite his heel. His heel. What's the word in the Torah for heel? Akev. A cave. Wow. So the heel is the origin story of where the serpent is given superpowers to wipe us out. Because you see, the serpent is a metaphor for what? For your dark side, what we call the Yetzer Hara, your evil inclination. The serpent was a physical manifestation, however you want to understand the story, allegorically, literally. But that serpent is the serpent that challenges each and every one of us. And what does the serpent do? You know what he does? He only has one place on your body that he's given license to attack you. Where is that? Your heel. Wow. And what does a serpent do? He bites the heel of a human being, metaphorically. And he injects his venom into the heel. How? Because you're trampling with your attitude on God's Bible by belittling and ignoring certain types of truths in the Bible. And therefore, it starts with just one One little thing that you don't like. It ticks you off. I like 612, but this one, I don't know, right? So it just starts with a bite, and the venom is only located in the heel of the human being. But if you don't deal with the venom, then what happens? It starts to permeate the human body. And the more it starts to permeate, then it starts to, unfortunately, poison the entirety of our relationship with God. In other words, if we don't deal with it when at the inception of the bite, then we allow the poison to go into our circulatory system, and heaven help us, right? So it's an amazing idea because it all comes from the heel. Now let me ask you a question. How do you confront the snake? There's only one person in Jewish history who ever went mano a mano, WrestleMania number one, the greatest WrestleMania of all before Hulk Hogan and Andre the Giant. May they rest in peace. The greatest of all time was a wrestling match between a man named Jacob and a man who's identified as the Yetzirah, the evil inclination, Esau's angel. And it happens in the Bible, very, very famous story, where Jacob is left alone from his family. Esau's coming to meet him with 400 soldiers the next day, and he's very scared. He's at night, and he's all alone. And this mysterious man, a man who sometimes is an angel. We don't know whether it was an external struggle or the Luke Skywalker, if you're fans of Luke Skywalker, there's this amazing little thing, I think in one of the first two movies, where he has like an internal battle, ends up stabbing himself with his own lightsaber, and he sees the Darth Vader side of himself, not knowing that Darth Vader is his father. So for those Hasidim of the Star Wars, you understand this. For the rest of you, are looking at me like I am whacked. And I am a little wacky, but it's a great parallel, okay? If you're a Star Wars person, this resonates with you. If you're not, I'm sorry. Now, what happens? Jacob fights with this entity, and they fight all night. And finally, the entity tries to destroy him. It shows him flawed genetics in the future and attacks his future. Hence, you get the sciatic nerve where it hurts poor Jacob. And unfortunately for us, it ruins our ability to have the best cut of snake in the world, the sirloin filet mignons. All right. But Jacob is unrelenting. Even on one leg, he wins the battle. And the next morning, the sun's coming up, and this mysterious stranger says, Jacob, I got to go sing songs to God in heaven. Release me. And he says, no, I'm not going to release you until you tell me up front. I get the blessings. I'm the first Jew. I want Israel. He says, but you're going to get the blessing from God. No, I want it from you. You're the entity that fought me. I won. You need to give me public announcement. I want a proclamation. My name is now Israel. Boom, the angel names him Israel, and the angel leaves. So who was that angel? So again, it's mysterious. We believe it to be the Yetzirah, the evil inclination. From the inception of mankind, all the way up to the moment of that wrestling match with Jacob and that mysterious entity, no one ever went mano a mano and won against his own dark side. That dark side, whatever it is, we all have our Yetzirah. For each of us, our dark side is different because it manifests itself knowing where our weaknesses are. It could be a multiplicity of weaknesses that every human being has. And when you conquer one, like I'll give you an example. Let's say a person, loves drinking to the point where they have to join AA. So what happens? They join AA and they say, bravo, mazel tov, here's your little, the cake night and everything else you get for AA. But you have to be careful because there are other things. Sometimes the person who's addicted, all of a sudden they start smoking. So it just switches off. You conquer one, then it goes to something else. It's never enough because the Yetzirah keeps probing. The evil inclination keeps looking for weaknesses in our psyche and trying to tempt us. But Jacob beat him. Would it surprise you to know what Jacob's name means? Heel. He's Achav. He is the master of the heel. In other words, Jacob, his very essence, as Jacob, is the one who is the heel. He is the first and greatest human being who successfully navigated this concept of not allowing himself attitudinally to be subject to the whims of this evil inclination that was tempting him, trying to whisper sweet nothings in his ear to sabotage his relationship with God by trampling in the king's orchard. And Jacob said, I'm not going to have any of this. I will not trample in the king's orchard. So Mr. Heel, Yaakov, successfully navigates here and attitudinally gives us, because we have his genetics, as the children of Israel, a of the children of Jacob, we have Israel in our blood. Whether it's by choice or by birth, we have Israel. And if we have Israel, we have the potentiality, the koach, the strength, the resolve to conquer that attitude that could deleteriously blight our relationship with our Creator and profoundly impact our ability to be who we should be. So again, the great news is, I can't say you're ever going to beat your Yetzirah, because you can't beat your dark side. Like I said, your dark side is there. And if you conquer one little thing that you have, okay, let's say you conquer your, I'm speaking personally, my love for, let's say, brownies and pasta. Guess what? So if you don't eat brownies and pasta, all of a sudden, that ice cream over there looks pretty good, you know? Right? It's never going to be sufficient, because there's always something to move on to. That's the nature of who we are. But you know what? At the end of the day, without that Yetzer Hara, without evil inclination tempting us, speaking sweet nothings, then we couldn't get reward for what we do. In other words, if we don't have a challenge. So the greater you are, the greater your resolve, the more powerful your personal little dark side has to be to allow you to overcome that temptation. For if it wouldn't be so, then what, you'd be like a robot. You wouldn't have free choice, correct? It's only because we have a free choice to not do what God says that allows us to get reward in this world and the next world, and allows us to control our heel and to not attitudinally trample on the king's orchard. So may it be in our merit for each of us today. I know it's been a little bit of a different class, very Torah-dic, very Bible-oriented. I hope that's different. It's okay with you all. So may it be that our attitudes are always good. May we enjoy the smorgasbords always, enjoy all the food, and we dare not trample on the king's orchard. And even if it's something that's a little mysterious to you, okay, file it away for future reference. That's all you have to say. I don't understand it, but you know what? I love God. I trust God, just like you trust your mom and dad. And they always tried to do what was best for us. God always gives us something that's the greatest elixir that will be the vaccine, the help that we need. So that should be our attitude, to continue to be better and better. And as we come to Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, a time when we're looking at self-measurement, trying to better ourselves, perhaps just pick something you don't really like. Pick something like the Brussels sprouts on the menu that maybe is not your first. I remember as a little boy, my mom forced me to finish the Brussels sprouts. I ended up eating with Jell-O, which is like really bad. Like looking back, I said, wait, what was I thinking? I got to put Jell-O and Brussels sprouts, but I couldn't leave the table as a little boy until I had my little mini cabbage, right? Yikes. And by the way, I love Brussels sprouts today. So my mom knew, she knew what we were talking about. So may we all be blessed with enjoying the Brussels sprouts of our lives. And I wish everyone a wonderful day. Thank you.